continues. What action are you prepared to take? Fire the sons of bitches, sell the company, move to Tahiti? Okay, let's craft a conversation that will lessen the possibility of those outcomes, at least in the near future. I feel strongly that our goal is to retain both Ken and Rick. John and I work together over the weekend to prepare. On Monday, he talks with Ken and Rick separately, then together. I meet with John and his six key executives the next day to debrief them about the findings from my interviews. Ken and Rick apologize to the executive team for the damage their rivalry has caused. I'm impressed. It takes a big person. I remind the executive team that fierce does not mean barbarous, menacing, or cruel. Fierce means powerful, strong, unrestrained, robust. It means coming out from behind ourselves into the conversation and making it real. There will be no blood on the floor, no violence. I talk about the principles and purposes of fierce conversations. I coach them regarding their role in our upcoming session, especially John, Ken, and Rick. I answer questions, turning most of the questions back to the executives to answer for themselves. I tell them, the answers are in the room. You have the answers. A week later, John, 40 vessel personnel, 15 office staff, and I engage in 2 days of memorable conversations. There are skid marks across the floor from heels dug in. I lay out the issues without mincing words. They are stunned as John and I describe what is really going on, naming each of the issues without putting pillows around them. I remind myself to breathe. I say that we will confront real issues, that confront does not mean argue or beat up. Confront means search for the truth. Honesty means full disclosure to myself and others with good intent. I tell them that we're going to take on the biggest, nastiest issue first, so we will find out what we are made of and go from there. We begin by addressing the rivalry between Ken and Rick. We experience our first moment of truth when Ken stands, faces everyone, and says, I have shown favorites amongst our vessels. I admit it. It's unacceptable, and I apologize. It's stopping now. Ken waits quietly as 54 people digest what he has said. The turning point comes when Richard, a highly regarded engineer, whose vessel is the one Ken had favored with equipment and supplies, stands and admits, It's put some of us in a difficult position, Ken. On the one hand, I appreciate what you've done for us, but it's made it hard to help out the guys on the other vessels, and that's what we're supposed to do. Ken looks like he's been kicked in the gut. Richard is one of Ken's most valuable employees. Ken shakes his head. This is not easy. Rick stands now. Some of you know I haven't felt good about... Hell, you all know I wanted Ken's job. I've made no bones about that, but that wasn't your problem. I made it your problem. Shouldn't have happened. Gonna fix it. The attendees, whom John and I have invited to come out from behind themselves, then begin to show up authentically, honestly. Some defend. Others reveal the amazing grace of those who engage without defense. They set the bar for the rest of us. Through it all, John is impeccable. He asks questions, and when he asks, he's really asking. He listens thoughtfully, offers the perspective that only he can offer, and when he answers questions, he really answers them, doesn't duck them. Things happened as a result of the session. Rick wasn't sure he could accept the changes he'd have to make. He resigned to take another job, was gone for 1 week, and asked to return. John took him back. Rick returned, slightly humbled. Ken and Rick still engaged in minor power struggles, but the struggles were less visible to the larger community. Vessel favoritism was stopped dead in its tracks. Communication among vessels became timely and accurate. All vessels caught fish. Reports were accurate. Morale turned around. Later, John said, I'm proud of my company and what we've accomplished. He has a right to be. Though John's story concerns a unique industry, the issues are similar to those in many organizations, high-tech, low-tech, no-tech. They include competition for titles and bragging rights among individuals and teams, lack of appreciation for others' realities, competition for scarce resources, tolerance of the ineffective or harmful behavior of a high performer, or of entrenched victims who feel, he did it to me, she did it to me, they did it to me, it's not my fault, not my problem. Several years ago, I was introduced to the military term ground truth, which refers to what's actually happening on the ground versus the official tactics. One of the challenges worth going after in any organization, be it a company or a marriage, is getting to ground truth. Seems to me you have to get at ground truth before you can turn anything around. You have to master the courage to interrogate reality in your organization, to get at ground truth publicly, no hidden agenda. What is ground truth in your organization? Every day, companies falter and fail because the difference between ground truth and the official truth is significant. The official truth is available for general circulation and is viewed by most team members as propaganda. Ground truth is discussed around the water cooler, in the bathrooms, and in the parking lot, but is seldom offered for public consumption and rarely shows up when you need it most, when the entire team is assembled to discuss how to introduce a new product or to debrief the loss of a valuable customer and figure out how to prevent it from happening again. I recently talked with a friend who attends the kinds of high-level political meetings you read about in thrillers. He reminded me that politicians are adept at navigating within the sizable gap between ground truth and official truth. Everyone is careful, guarded. No one admits to vulnerability, to failure, that they are not the center of the universe, that they are not in control. My friend went on to say that the China policy is referred to as the China policy of ambiguity. All communications on the topic are oblique and soft. Nothing anyone says has any meat on the bones. Trying to enforce anything would be like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. Following the September 11 attack on America, however, political dialogue got real in a hurry. It had to. Buildings had literally come to ground. And now we had to come to ground as well, to ground truths. Individuals all over the world began to understand that in a very real sense, the progress of the world depends on the progress of each individual human being. Now, leadership must be for the world rather than being an appeasement of individuals with special interests. None of us can afford to operate in that mode. Certainly companies can't. There's this little matter called profitability. Profitability requires an ongoing interrogation of reality, of ground truth. John Tompkins' official truth had been that the competition between his two highly capable operations executives was invisible to the rest of the organization. He had convinced himself that a little creative tension between top executives could be tolerated. Meanwhile, ground truth was inflicting significant harm on a daily basis. What conversation can we have with one another to help our collective understanding of ground truth? Let's examine current reality. We need to ask, what has changed since last we met? Where are we succeeding? Where are we failing? What have we learned in the last few months? What is required of us now? Each of us needs honest answers to these questions in the workplace and at home. We can begin by identifying the official truths in our organizations and in our relationships that conflict with ground truth. Before you listen further, stop for a moment and have a quiet conversation with yourself. Are there differences between official truths and ground truths in your workplace, in your personal relationships, in your life? Here are two examples to help you think about this. my organization's official truth is that our goal is to be world class in everything we do. Ground truth is that many of us are embarrassed by frequent blunders which have not been acknowledged or addressed. The official truth in my marriage is that we are happy, that everything is fine. Ground truth is that we've been avoiding significant issues. If we fail to resolve them, our marriage could fail. The official truth in my life is that I am on track to be successful. Ground truth is that my job is unfulfilling. I'm just going through the motions. Fierce conversations with yourself, such as these, are not for the faint of heart. They require courage, from the French word cœur, meaning heart. They are conversations during which you're likely to overhear yourself saying things you didn't know you knew or didn't want to know. We each have our own sense of the reality of any situation, our own truths. These truths can be far removed from reality and often cause our conversations to travel the same ground over and over and over again. I'm reminded of the story of the man who visits a Zen master. The man asks, "What truths can you teach me?" The master replies, "Do you like tea?" The man nods his head and the master pours him a cup of tea. The cup fills and the tea spills. Still the master pours. The man, of course, protests and the master responds, "Return to me when you are empty." The lesson here is that we need to empty ourselves of our preconceived beliefs in order to be open to a broader, more complex reality. During fierce conversations, we are more likely to get all our answers questioned than the other way around. Before we can learn, we must unlearn, empty the cup. When it comes to profitability, keeping our businesses healthy and growing, we must determine whether the assumptions on which our organization was built and is being run match current reality. What kind of assumptions? Assumptions about markets, about customers and competitors, about values, beliefs, and behavior, about technology and its dynamics, about the organization's strengths and weaknesses, even assumptions about what the company gets paid to do. These assumptions are what Peter Drucker would call the company's theory of the business, and they need to be regularly and rigorously interrogated. To test these assumptions, organizations must interrogate two realities at once, engage in two ongoing fierce conversations. The first has to do with the organization's values. The question posed is, what values do we stand for? And are there gaps between these values and how we actually behave? The corporate soul reflects shared values. Embedded in the reasons we get out of bed every day and in every action that we take as individuals are our values. A value is a tightly held belief upon which a person or organization acts by choice. It is an enduring belief that one way of behaving is personally, professionally, spiritually, or socially preferable to an opposing way of behaving. In considering your values and any gaps that might exist between those values and your behavior, there's more at stake in interrogating this particular reality than most of us realize. Psychoneuroimmunology is a field in which medical physicians and quantum physicists have met, shaken hands, and engaged in a startling conversation. It seems that you and I have the ability to strengthen or weaken our own immune systems. The surprising news is that it has less to do with a healthy diet or an exercise regimen and more to do with the degree of integrity with which we live our lives. Does psychoneuroimmunology suggest that if you get sick, you're a bad person? No. Bad things happen to good people. Maybe you just caught a bug. Maybe you inherited a troublesome gene. However, if you feel a creeping, deadening depression, a malaise, and if you're tired and listless much of the time, if you sense something's off, then do an integrity scan. Ask yourself, What values do I stand for? And are there gaps between these values and how I actually behave? In fact, if you are depressed, it may be because you have repressed some important truths from yourself, truths about yourself. Integrity requires alignment of our values and our actions. So if, for example, you say that you value time with your family members, yet haven't spent much time with them lately, you are, by your own definition, out of integrity. If you've taken the stand that fidelity in a marriage is essential and you're cheating on your spouse, you're out of integrity. If you tell yourself that honesty is important, yet you frequently bend the truth in an attempt to stay out of trouble or get what you want, you're out of integrity. All too often, there's quite a difference between stated values and ground truth. Most of us don't go around consciously violating our values, however. If your behavior contradicts your values, your body knows, and you pay a price at a cellular level. Over time, depending on the severity of the integrity outage and how long it's been going on, your immune system will weaken, leaving you increasingly vulnerable to illness. If behaviors within an organization are not in alignment with the values stated so prettily in the mission statement, the company's immune system is weak, rendering it vulnerable when opportunities to get sick come along. Bad things happen to good companies. When a company takes a blow, if the corporate immune system is weak, things can go south in a heartbeat. And what happens in your marriage during a tough time? What integrity outages are causing or contributing to a bad patch? Do you support each other through the difficult times, or do the wheels come off the cart? Pay attention here. When bad things happen at work or at home, if our corporate or personal immune systems are weak, it's likely that things will worsen. On the other hand, when bad things happen and our immune systems are strong, our defense system can kick in and return us to health. What if we know we're out of integrity and happen to do nothing about it? If we continue to ignore that part of us that says, this is wrong, this is not right for me, we're playing Russian roulette with our physical, emotional, spiritual, and financial health. Sadly for many, we have only to hear the name Enron to recognize a spectacular example of corporate psychoneuroimmunology at its most devastating. Your assignment now is to conduct an integrity scan. In preparation for your integrity scan, you must first clarify your values. It won't do to spout the values that have been suggested to you by others, even by those whom you admire. The question is, what are your values? A value I've identified for myself is passionate engagement. Looking back on personal and professional peaks and valleys, I find that I do the best work and enjoy my life most when my passions are thoroughly engaged. Authenticity is another core value for me. Just the sound of the word creates a thrumming in my bones. When I work with clients, there's often a sense of personal discovery when the right words spring to mind. One woman in a workshop regained her resolve to take a class in writing once she realized her life had fallen into a routine that had dulled her sense of aliveness. She said, "I'm too comfortable. I haven't learned anything new in a long time. I've always said that a lifetime of learning is one of my core values, yet I'm in a rut in just about every area of my life. No wonder I'm so bored." Look for the words that speak to you, that wake you up. Don't worry about what anyone thinks of your list of values. This is your life. You and only you decide. Ask yourself if your behavior is out of alignment with your values in the workplace, in your personal relationship, and in your life. If so, where and what are they? This will be one of the most important conversations you will ever have with yourself and deserves annual revisits. If you are a leader in an organization, invite your team to conduct a corporate integrity scan. In preparation, review your company's vision or mission statement. Does it include clearly stated values? Is it compelling? Most vision statements sound the same, containing such sentiments as, we will be the premier provider of insert your product or service here in whatever your geographic territory is. We will exceed our customers' expectations, provide growth opportunities for our employees, and ensure a reasonable return for our shareholders. Boring. There is no vitality in such statements, and unless I'm a shareholder, who cares? The language doesn't provide us with anything we can sink our emotional teeth into. It doesn't compel us to take action. People yearn to be connected to something of substance. They are oriented to values. Few employees are content with a merely contractual relationship in which they exchange their time and skills for a paycheck, then go home to spend their paychecks on what their lives are really about. Most care deeply about the reputation and values of the companies they work for, and would like to feel that their ability to live up to those values in their organization matters. A compelling vision, including shared values, is not just an idea. It is, rather, a force in people's hearts, a force of impressive power. Few, if any, forces in human affairs are as powerful as shared vision. The best kind of vision statement is written during a 4-hour fierce conversation with as many employees as possible. It answers 4 important questions. Why are we here? What is our ideal relationship with one another? What is our ideal relationship with our customers? And what contribution do we wish to make to the global community? If your vision statement needs rewriting, involve as many employees, customers, and strategic partners as possible in doing so. Periodically review it with your coworkers and ask, where are we off? If an integrity outage becomes clear, discuss what needs to be done to correct it. Develop a plan that includes specific actions and dates by which they will be taken. Thank the team for their candid responses. Conclude your integrity scan by identifying where the company's behavior is in alignment with its values. Ask the team, where are we on? Thank them for their contributions to the company's alignment of values and behaviors, and let them know what it means personally to you, their leader. Now let's take a look at a second reality every organization must regularly examine, namely, what are the skills and talents of our employees, and are there gaps between those resources and what the market demands? Several years ago, I sat in on a meeting of managing directors in Edinburgh, Scotland. Once I got past my enchantment with the brogue and could pay attention to the issues being discussed, my thought was, they have the same issues as the CEOs in Seattle and London and Indianapolis and Sydney. The common thread? People. When solving problems, producing results, or addressing strategy, we invariably turn to the performance of individual employees. Do we have the talented people we need to successfully deliver our product or service to our customers? It's been interesting to note that the vast majority of leaders with whom I've worked, who for the most part are fairly well grounded in reality, tend to hold out hope that marginal employees will magically transform themselves overnight into high performers. I don't know about you, but I have not yet witnessed a spontaneous recovery from incompetence. What's needed is a fierce conversation, perhaps a series of them, followed by relentless follow-through and ongoing support. While some people can't be saved, many can. Most people will comply with clear requests. Perhaps the fierce question leaders need to ask themselves is, were my employees dead when I hired them or did I kill them? As a leader, you get what you tolerate. People do not repeat behavior unless it is rewarded. The same goes for our families, our marriages, our friendships. For example, what are your children doing? How are they spending their time? And what are the results? Have you communicated clearly not only the results, but also the behavior that you want? What about attitude? I appreciate the comments of Herb Kelleher, the chairman of the board of Southwest Airlines, who said, We are prepared, including legally, to fire you for a bad attitude. Southwest Airlines employees are rarely accused of sleepwalking through the manual. Instead, they bring a playfulness and individuality to their work. How does an airline get this behavior out of its employees? By clearly communicating what is expected. During all of my conversations with Peter Schutz, former president of Porsche, his message was consistent. Hire attitude, train skill. Peter was successful in large part because he was clear about the attitude he was looking for at Porsche. The key question is, what attitudes will lead to success in our company? The follow-up question is, to what degree do our employees exhibit these attitudes? How do the two realities we've explored for companies apply to you as an individual? You've already interrogated the first reality by conducting a personal integrity scan. What values do I stand for, and are there gaps between these values and how I actually behave? We need only to modify the second reality slightly to make it deeply personal as well. What are my skills and talents? And are there gaps between those talents and what I'm bringing to the job market, to my career, and to my personal relationships? In Studs Terkel's book, Working, a young woman named Nora describes her excitement when she landed her first real job after college. It was for a large, well-known company, and she was intent on bringing everything she was and everything she had learned to the task at hand. The trouble was, her coworkers made it clear, in subtle and not so subtle ways, that if she brought everything she had to the task, she would wreck the curve for everyone else. Nora said, "Within a few weeks, as I was driving to work, I psyched myself down for a job that was too small for me. Within a month, I had absented my spirit from the work." When I read that phrase, absented my spirit, it went through me like a chill. What a price to pay, both for Nora and for her company. No one does herself or her company any favors by staying in a job in which there is very little of her that's alive. Perhaps your current job isn't the right place for you, and you know it. Perhaps it is asking only a small fraction of what you are capable of delivering, and every attempt to deliver more has been denied. Perhaps your job requires you to deliver results that hold little interest for you, or that are beyond your capabilities. Maybe you've been telling yourself that it's not so bad where you are, that while it may not be your dream job, you've gotten used to it, that it's actually kind of comfortable here. You've got a salary and benefits and a place to go 5 days a week. After all, you've got only 15 years until retirement. You can hang on until then for the sake of keeping a roof over your family's heads. What happens in your gut when you hear yourself thinking this way? Meanwhile, you have dreams of breaking free, of a different career altogether. In fact, there are days when you'd rather write, teach, work in a paint store, drive a forklift, sell seashells on the seashore, anything except the job to which you are currently attached. One of my colleagues, Pat Murray, suggests if you want to see someone in real pain, watch someone who knows who he is and defaults on it on a regular basis. If there's no joy in Mudville when you contemplate your job, if you live only for weekends, you are in real pain. Yet often the companies we work for are the right companies, and the problem is that we are in the wrong place in the company or underutilized in our job. Perhaps a fierce conversation with coworkers can open doors to new, more satisfying challenges. However, if your job is no longer appropriate or sufficient for you and the situation cannot be remedied unless you were to become a different human being entirely, it's time to leave. It may be time to screw your courage to the sticking place and fire yourself. Make yourself available to industry. Make yourself available to whatever is out there with your name on it. Ask yourself these two questions. What activities have heart for me? and what am I called to do? And if you're still hesitating, ask yourself, is the personal cost I'm paying really worth it? As we've discussed, one of the rules of engagement for companies, couples, and individuals who are practicing the principles of fierce conversations is that while no one has to change, everyone has to have the conversation. When we are real with ourselves and others, the change occurs before the conversation has ended. Insights about who we are and what we really want and need are already at work, revealing the way we must go. And what if the path with your name on it requires a radical upheaval of life as you know it? What if you recognize that to step into a more pleasing life, you must change career direction entirely? You may be thinking, if I do what I really want to do, I will make less money. How would my family feel about simplifying our lifestyle, cutting back on expenditures? What would people think? After all, everyone thinks I'm successful where I am. My response to such concerns is addressed by a definition of success that has served me well for many years. I am successful to the degree that who I am and what I live are in alignment. In getting to this place of alignment, one thing is clear: the quality of our lives is largely determined by the quality of the questions we ask and the quality of our answers. Answered thoughtfully and candidly, the right questions offer the possibility of a life that is much more than a satisfactory compromise. What are the right questions? They are the big questions that define your ideal future. They include, where am I going? Why am I going there? Who is going with me? How am I going to get there? And am I realizing my full potential? Is there value and fulfillment in my work today? The biggest barrier to addressing such questions is fear of the journey, fear of discovering who we are, or the impermanence of who we are. Yet these questions are compelling because they lead to an imminently desirable outcome. They enable deep, positive, personal change. They open up possibilities not previously accessible. How do you build this internal context? Articulate the highest and best contribution your company, your family, and your life can make. We'll take a closer look at several of these questions when we discuss my second principle next. Already you've begun to focus on your reality, on what color the beach ball is from your perspective. You've clarified your core values and engaged in a fierce conversation with yourself about your life's focus and that of your company and your career. Now let's discuss how to make your conversations real.
Principle 2. Come out from behind yourself into the conversation and make it real.
You are an original, an utterly unique human being. You cannot have the life you want, make the decisions you want, or be the leader you are capable of being until your actions represent an authentic expression of who you really are or who you wish to become. In the context of fierce conversations, authenticity requires that you pay attention to Woody Allen's first rule of enlightenment, show up. You must deliberately, purposefully, come out from behind yourself into the conversation and make it real, at least your part of it. But aren't most people pretty real during a conversation, you ask? I wish I could answer with a resounding yes, but even when you are committed to authenticity, it can be surprisingly difficult. If you listened in on my conversations with employees, learned their views of their organization's strategy, and then watched them reverse their positions in the presence of higher-ups, you might conclude, as did Martin Amis, that we are out there on the cutting edge of the uncontroversial. In news reports, we often read that someone was speaking on condition of anonymity. A near pathological anonymity and inauthenticity is the stuff of many lives. A friend whose mother had recently died said, "My mother never shared her dark days, her troubles with me. I don't feel I really knew her. How real are any of us if we do not share our dark days with those closest to us, if we do not claim our failures as well as our successes? Authenticity is not something you have, it is something you choose. Even individuals who wield significant power at times withhold their real thoughts and feelings from those central to their success and happiness. It has much to do with an underlying impulse to survive by gaining the approval and support of others, boss, customer, coworker, family member, significant other, who we imagine hold the keys to the warehouse wherein is kept everything we want and need. To ensure that such power brokers are on our team, we aim to please. While the desire to please is not a flaw, at crucial crossroads we sometimes go too far. Way too far. When faced with a so-called moment of truth, we find ourselves chucking the truth over the fence, tucking it behind the drapes in exchange for a trinket of approval. What's that behind the curtain, you ask? Oh, nothing important, just my entire identity. May I refill your glass? Some fear that becoming authentic is a form of selfishness and unknowingly limit the possibilities within their relationships, feeling it's inappropriate to put their own interests first. After all, what would people think? During a workshop, Lauren, a delightful woman in her 40s, described the unsettling experience of awaking one morning unrecognizable to herself. Having spent a lifetime accommodating the needs and desires of so many others, both at work and at home, she had developed amnesia about who she was and what it was she had wanted to do with her life when she was younger and all the possibilities seemed so vast. At another workshop, a participant said, "I always drive carefully when there's someone important with me in the car." It took her a moment to understand why everyone in the room was gasping. Do you think you shouldn't need the help, support, or experiences that make you happy? Do you tell yourself I shouldn't need to be told that I am loved? Or do you think I really need to talk this issue through with my boss, but she has different priorities? Consider this. Successful relationships require that all parties view getting their core needs met as being legitimate. You won't articulate your needs to yourself, much less to your work team or life partner, until and unless you see getting your needs met as a reasonable expectation. So pry the permission door open just far enough to consider that you have a right to clarify your position, state your view of reality, and ask for what you want. Coming out from behind yourself is part of the search, whether born of panic or courage, for that highly personalized rapture of feeling completely yourself. Happy in your own skin. It is a reach for authenticity. When you cease to compare yourself to others and choose instead to live your life, it's an opportunity to raise the bar on the experience of your life. It is a deepening of integrity when who you are and what you live are brought into alignment. No more damping down your soul's deepest longings in order to get approval from others. As André Gide wrote, "It is better to fail at your own life than succeed at someone else's." Authenticity is a powerful attractor. When we free our true selves and release the energy, others recognize it and respond. The good news and the bad news is the same news. The news is our companies, our relationships, and our lives are mirrors accurately reflecting us back to ourselves. The results with which we are pleased reflect parts of ourselves that are working well. The results that disappoint and displease us reflect aspects of ourselves that simply aren't working. Doug Stone, author of Difficult Conversations, suggests, "To say of someone he died with his identity intact is not a compliment." When our idealized views of ourselves are set in stone despite evidence that there's an imperfection or two, The people in our lives have little recourse other than to work around our flaws or to leave. We can see an organization or a department or a relationship with clarity only when we look ourselves full in the face. In my workshops, I ask participants, barring all else, what is one word or phrase that absolutely describes you? Before you listen further, take a moment and do this for yourself. What is a word or phrase that unfailingly describes you? Stephen, a workshop participant, recently declared with great conviction, "The word is focus. Everyone who knows me will tell you that I'm focused on what's important and getting it done." After everyone had shared their words, I suggested, think of times and situations when you are exactly the opposite of this. Some participants insist, "I'm never the opposite." When pressed to identify a time when he is not focused, Stephen realized that while he is extraordinarily focused in his job, many weekends are given over to aimless activities. "I'm just hanging out, slumped in a chair, watching TV, eating chips. I'm not focused on quality time with my wife or achieving personal goals. I told myself I was going to pick up a guitar I haven't touched in years. It's still in the closet, missing two strings." The purpose of this exercise is to help us recognize the multiple realities about how each of us shows up in the world, not just when we're at our best. If we are to develop as leaders, as human beings, our very identities must become fluid. For example, is it a fact that you are fair-minded, good-hearted, and generous of spirit? Okay. Have you ever wished, just for a moment, that something bad would happen to someone who has wronged you? Well, that's true about you, too. It's neither good nor bad. It's just what is. One of the most painful realizations upon reaching 40 or 50 or 60 can be that you have no discernible identity, that somehow your identity has been compromised. It's not that your credit card or social security number was stolen. It's that an internal voice is whispering, insisting, "This isn't you. This isn't enough of you. Parts of you are failing to show up." In Steve Tesich's novel, Carew, Saul Carew admits, "It occurred to me that I wasn't a human being anymore, probably hadn't been for some time. I was a loose cannon, whose spin and charge and direction could be reversed at any moment by forces outside myself." It is through such humbling insights into ourselves that we come to know, reshape, and trust the self we may then offer to others. It takes courage to look at ourselves unflinchingly in the mirror called our lives. Sometimes what we see isn't particularly attractive. It has been said that the truth will set you free, but first it may thoroughly irritate you. Let me tell you about Tom. Everyone likes Tom Porro, a member of a group of key executives that I chaired in Seattle for many years. He's funny, good-natured, candid, authentic, and skilled at putting his finger on the source of any issue under discussion. Tom's metabolism is the envy of everyone. He appears not to have 1 ounce of fat on him. Yes, we hate him for that. His mind is equally lean and mean. A few years ago, Don Aubrey, another member of the group, introduced Tom to mountain climbing. Don was all grins as Tom eventually bought every piece of climbing gear known to man and spent as much time as his wife would tolerate learning the sport. In fact, just before his and Don's planned climb of Mount Rainier, Tom had spent 13 days climbing in Alaska. The four-person climbing party had purposefully split up. Don and JJ, an experienced female climber, got a 4-hour head start. They planned to research base camp, recuperate, and greet Tom and Mike, the climb leader, with a hot meal. At around 10 o'clock in the morning, halfway to base camp, Don and JJ came to a glacier where bamboo poles marked the recommended route around a crevasse. A snow bridge offered an enticingly direct, shorter route to base camp. The snow bridge seemed solid. However, after Don carefully examined the dark crevasse, the path marked by the poles was clearly the wiser choice. He and JJ took the longer route. When they arrived at base camp, it was sunny and clear. Tom and the leader arrived at the glacier at about 2 p.m. Tom glanced toward the crevasse, then at the bamboo poles. Tom and Mike had discussed route options, and Tom was to take the lead on this section of the climb. Tom turned to Mike and said, "I vote for the snow bridge." Tom moved quickly, without roping up. As Mike stood to shoulder his pack, he was horrified to see the top of Tom's head disappearing as the snow bridge collapsed beneath him. As Tom fell, he glanced off the ice walls, breaking something with each hit. A rib, the cheekbone supporting his left eye. Another rib, an ankle, another rib. With each collision with the icy walls of the crevasse, Tom wondered, is this the one that's going to break my neck? Is this my last moment of consciousness? Tom fell the equivalent of 7 stories. If he had not landed on a 3-foot-wide ledge of ice, he would still be down there. It took hours to get him out of the deep, narrow icebox. When Don and JJ heard about the accident on their radio, it was too late to get back down the mountain, so it was the next day before they could retrace their steps. On the way down the mountain, Don photographed the crevasse. He and JJ stopped at a 1-hour photo developing shop and got the film developed. When they walked into Tom's hospital room, the first thing Tom said was, "That crevasse came out of nowhere." This was your basic moment of truth. The executives in Don and Tom's group have had many a fierce conversation over the years, and this seemed like a prime candidate for another one. Don took a deep breath and said, "You look like hell, buddy. I'm awful glad you're alive. But that crevasse didn't come out of nowhere. It was risky enough at 10 a.m. Look at this photo. You got there 4 hours later, 4 more hours of melting in full sun. What the hell were you pretending not to know?" Tom did look awful. Since one of his eyeballs was hanging disconcertingly low in its socket, he could barely see the photos. He squinted and moved the photos farther from and closer to his face, attempting to focus. After about a minute, Tom became abnormally still, not at all like our familiar attention-deficited friend. After a long silence, he murmured, "God Almighty, what was I pretending not to know?" At a meeting 2 months later, Tom hobbled in for a session with the group. We insisted on a blow-by-blow account of the entire misadventure, which was sobering and graphic. After Tom had answered all of our questions, he shared his insight. "Well, now I know what a fierce conversation is. I had the fiercest one of my life while plummeting 7 stories into a crevasse. It was brief, but memorable." We all laughed as Tom continued, "Lying in the hospital forced me to lie still and think about some things. I saw that the way I approach that crevasse is pretty much the way I live my life. 1 foot after the other, head down, don't look up, no time, just move, now, 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 what's coming next? Sorry, too busy, got things to do." We nodded. We knew Tom, and we knew ourselves. Most of us weren't much different. Then Tom added quietly, "It almost cost me my life." While most of us don't behave in ways that put our lives at risk, without realizing it, we often put our careers and our marriages at risk at the conference table or the kitchen table by operating much of the time like Tom, by not paying attention to what others are really saying or asking, not even to our own words. Instead, we thoughtlessly string meaningless words together, all the while complaining that today seems an awful lot like yesterday. The next 4 assignments will help you show up to yourself. They will require you to be notorious, but let's face it, you've tried prudent planning long enough. It's time to show up in 3D, Technicolor, widescreen, Dolby surround sound to yourself. Even perhaps to overhear yourself saying things you didn't know you knew. It is highly likely that your own learning will be provoked. First, do a gut check on how you feel about your life today. Annie Dillard wrote, "How we spend our days is how we spend our lives." How are you spending your days, your life? Write down how you feel about yourself, your life, and your work. Several words or phrases that capture your thoughts and emotions. Your second assignment is to describe key aspects of the future you desire. Do this by writing your own personal stump speech. There are several forms of stump speeches. For your stump speech, I suggest you take a broad perspective. You'll answer four questions. Where am I going? Why am I going there? Who is going with me? How will I get there? It helps to pull back from your life and look at it as if you're the screenwriter, director, producer, and star. What's the plot? What's the story? What's the arc? What's the ending? You can't always foresee the interesting side trips you may take, but where are you headed? A trajectory and destination are essential to clarify, even though you will likely make course corrections throughout your life. But for now, where you are today, take a stand for the ideal future you envision. This exercise requires and deserves time, ideally a 1 or 2 day personal retreat. At a minimum, several hours. Your living room will work just fine. If possible, though, I suggest that you get out of your everyday environment. A change in your literal horizon will boost your ability to see new horizons for your life and career. This fierce conversation with oneself, during which we revisit our personal stump speech, has become so valuable to me through the years that I go to considerable lengths to ensure the quality of that conversation. Each September, I take a long walk, typically 5 to 7 days, alone. The purpose of my September walks is to revisit, reclarify, and recommit to what my soul desires. Why is it so important to spend time conversing with ourselves? Because all conversations are with myself, and sometimes they involve other people. This is incredibly important to understand. Embracing this insight changes the way we relate to and interact with everyone in our lives. I may think I see you as you are, but in truth, I see you as I am. The implications are staggering, not the least of which is this: the issues in my life are rarely about you. They are almost always about me. This means that I cannot come out from behind myself into conversations with others and make them real until I know who I am and what I intend to do with my life. Each of us must first answer the question, "Where am I going?" before we can address the question, "Who is going with me?" It is essential not to get those out of order. Whether you end up spending 4 hours at home or manage to get away for a day or two, I assure you that your work, your relationships, and your life will begin to transform as a result of addressing these questions. You will bring into your life whatever it is that you have the most clarity about. Don't allow your inner critic to edit your answers to the stump speech questions. Set reality considerations aside. Just write whatever comes to mind. If you hear yourself answering, "I don't know," to any of the questions, ask yourself, "What would it be if I did know?" Now that you've written your personal stump speech, you're ready to list the fierce conversations you need to have with others. They may be the conversations you've been assiduously avoiding for months or years. Some of them may be about the undiscussables in your life, the topics that you and others have been avoiding at home or at work, the topics that need to be addressed and resolved in order for you to move forward. You won't address them quite yet, but it's time to identify them. Write down the name of each person and a sentence or two about the topic for the conversation. For example, the person you want to have a fierce conversation with is Bob, your boss. The topic is your career ambitions. In particular, you desire to prove yourself a worthy candidate for the position of VP of Operations. Or as another example, the person you want to talk with is Jane, your wife. We're both so busy, we haven't spent much time together or had many laughs lately. I'm worried that our relationship is becoming stale. How do we resolve the challenges of our busy lives and create quality time together? Think of all the fierce conversations you need to have. Finally, for your fourth assignment, before you have conversations with anyone else, you'll have one with yourself. Earlier, you were introduced to the idea of the mineral rights conversation that I had with John Tompkins. Now I'd like you to have it with yourself. Take on the issue that is troubling you the most, perhaps the one that you least want to face, the one you sense may require courage you're not sure you have. You'll need an hour, alone, uninterrupted. In preparation, identify your single most pressing issue. Something that is currently going on in your professional or personal life that you want and need to resolve. In workshops, participants' issues cover a wide range, including these. My company's strategic plan looks good on paper, but it's not being implemented. We're headed for a bad day. My marriage is stagnant. My wife and I are housemates, not lovers. I'm overweight. If I don't make a change, my health will suffer. My daughter may be doing drugs. I know she'll deny it. Or, I'm successful in my work, but my personal relationships keep failing. I don't want to end up alone, but it looks like that's where I'm headed. To the degree that you are fierce with yourself, passionate, real, uncensored, a mineral rights conversation will help you explore issues by mining for greater clarity, improved understanding, and impetus for change. It will shine a bright light on that issue of yours, the one growling in the dungeon, and you'll live to tell about it. So now it's time to begin. You'll need to write down your responses to each of the 7 questions or steps. Do not edit your responses, just write. Step 1. Identify your most pressing issue. Ask yourself, the issue that I most need to resolve is... Step 2. Clarify the issue. Ask yourself, what is going on? How long has this been going on? How bad are things? Step 3. Determine the current impact. Ask yourself, how is this issue currently impacting me? How is this issue currently impacting others? When I consider the impact on myself and others, what are my emotions? Step 4, determine the future implications. Ask yourself, if nothing changes, what's likely to happen? What's at stake for me and others relative to this issue? When I consider these possible outcomes, what are my emotions? Step 5. Examine your personal contribution to this issue. Ask yourself, how have I contributed to the problem? Step 6. Describe the ideal outcome. Ask yourself, when this issue is resolved, what difference will that make? What results will I enjoy? What results will others enjoy? And when I imagine this resolution, what are my emotions? And finally, step 7, commit to action. Ask yourself, what is the most potent step I could take to move this issue toward resolution? What's going to attempt to get in my way, and how will I get past it, and when will I take this step? After you've gone through these 7 steps, draw up a contract with yourself. The contract can read, "During this fierce conversation with myself, I've identified a potent step to take to begin to resolve this issue. I've chosen the date by which I will take this step. There will be other steps, perhaps many of them,